Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. I'm Kwabe Tafoi. The body count keeps rising. More than 500 people to have been killed in May. And in April, the deadliest month since June of 2008, the death toll at more than 700. The extent of the violence is increasingly reminiscent of the widespread sectarian fighting that peaked in 2006 and in 2007 and threatened to tear the country apart, the country being Iraq. But the question is, what is fanning the flames of this sectarianism? In this debate, we're going to be examining the roles of regional countries like Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, and ask our guests also about the U.S.'s role and what plans Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has to tackle this problem.
Terrorist attacks are raging on in Iraq. The latest series of bombings has targeted the capital Baghdad, the western city of Ramadi in Anbar province, and the city of Mosul in the north. The attacks have claimed more lives. Many people have been injured. This is the aftermath of the Baghdad blasts, which hit Qaradagh district. The power of one explosion has twisted this car into a mangled piece of metal.
This daily or patterns of car bomb attacks, daylight, let's say, in Baghdad and some other cities, is really unacceptable. I mean, for the people of Iraq who have suffered so much. And that's why you see the anger in people's eyes and statements.
Iraqi authorities say they've arrested 16 members of a terrorist network involved in bombings across the country. Terrorist attacks have killed more than 1,000 people across Iraq in less than 2 months. Iraqi authorities say the terrorist attacks are being carried out by al-Qaeda elements and the remnants of the former Ba'athist regime. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has pointed the finger at foreign countries on several occasions, blaming them for the wave of terror attacks that have rocked his country recently.
The militants are returning to use the political instability which has led to instability inside society as a result of sectarianism. The recent sectarian violence has links with foreign capitals.
The Iraqi Prime Minister previously accused Arab governments such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar, as well as Turkey, of provoking sectarianism in his country. The rising violence has highlighted the need for unity among all Iraqis in the face of terrorism.
If the politicians and the Sunni, Shia and Christian endowments and the politicians in the northern Kurdish region of Kurdistan, in addition to other important key figures in Iraq, meet and put an end to their discords, this will give an impression to the terrorists that the Iraqi politicians are able to overcome their differences and that they won't allow terrorists to infiltrate and shed more blood of innocent Iraqis.
Some analysts believe that the goal is to weaken Iraq and prevent the Maliki government from playing any role in the region. They are suspicious about the silence of the U.S. over the rising wave of terror attacks and believe the violence may be serving Washington's interests in the region.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Debate. From London, we have Zayed Al-Issa. He's an Iraq affairs expert who joins us. And Richard Weitz from the Center for Political Military Analysis from the Hudson Institute joins us from Washington. Gentlemen, welcome. I'd like to start with you, Richard Weitz. It's being reported as Iraq being on the brink of a civil war. Has the civil war started already, given the record high number of deaths?
Well, we've seen this kind of violence ebb and flow over the past few years. We're still not the level we were when the 2006, 2007, 2008 years, when it really was a civil war. We see these cycles of bombings and then protests and so on. We've got a structural problem in that the government in Baghdad has alienated the Kurds of the north and the Sunnis in other areas. And sometimes the alienation manifests itself in violence, but most often not. So there's normally some kind of triggering factor. Al-Qaeda organizes some kind of attack, or there's some dismissal or arrest of somebody. But we've seen this kind of violence before, and it's still not as serious as it was.
Well, you talked about a structural problem from the central government, and you mentioned the Kurds there. My question to you is, we're looking at, 500 people to be killed in May and April was the deadliest month since June of 2008. What is causing all of this, if you were to look at the push that has resulted in so many deaths?
Right. What I was trying to get at with the structural comment was that the we've got a sort of an awkward disconnect, an incongruence between the political system and the actual ethnic dynamics of the country. The Americans came in and tried to establish a federal system in which the federal government in Baghdad would have some powers, but then the Kurds and the Sunni and Shiite provinces would have a lot of local autonomy. But the problem is we've seen, I think, a bit of overreaching on the part of the central government to aggregate authority and that the local groups think should belong to them. And that's an underlying source of tension. There have been specific acts, arrests, a pattern seemed to show the government tends to arrest Sunni opposition leaders more than anybody else, and that's aggravated tensions. There certainly the Kurds have grown very cautious about the Maliki government. Though the specific acts of violence, I would think, are being organized by the Al-Qaeda groups that are a small minority, a small wing, dominated, of course, by Sunnis. But that appears to be an intermittent striking capacity that they will use periodically. But still not, it's not sufficient in itself to trigger a collapse of the government. It's something that I think the government can, both at the this more broadly conceived and then in terms of specifically the Maliki government itself, can endure for a
right.
while.
Zayed Al-Issa, can you please break this accusations that the Sunni are being marginalized and give us some examples of how that doesn't hold water? I have some examples, but of course I'm sure you're more of an expert on that than I am.
Thank you very much. Of course, I mean, that is the case. If we look at the realities on the ground, these accusations not only not hold any water, but flies in the face in the face of evidence and reality of the ground. Let's not forget that the Sunnis hold 8 ministerial positions. One of them is the finance minister before he resigned. He had also the vice presidency, and we had also the deputy prime minister. These are very prominent positions that minorities in other countries who are staunchly and closely allied to the United States, like Saudi Arabia, like Bahrain, where the majority is oppressed, like other countries, do not enjoy. And the other fact, there is accusations leveled at the central government that the terrorism laws, specifically Article 4, is directed against the Sunnis, which basically does not hold any water, because in reality, it was Nouri al-Maliki himself who led the forces, the government forces, towards Basra, and the people of Basra were subjected to harshest and the strictest implementations of the terrorism laws. The other fact as well is that when protests were held in southern areas, which are predominantly Shia areas like Basra, the security forces moved against those protests within 24 hours or 40 hours using massive disproportionate force. Now, if we compare that with the ongoing protests which are happening in Anbar, they have been there for more than 5 months. The authorities have been quite lenient with them, made huge number of concessions to them that the leaders of the protests have actually adamantly refused to acknowledge, adamantly refused to negotiate, refused to have anyone negotiate on their behalf, and they have persistently accused the government of marginalization. Now, to add to that, if you say that the Kurds have accused the governments of actually spreading its authority towards the Kurdish regional government, the Kurdish regional government has been acting independently, as if it is a completely independent state in everything all but name. It has its own foreign policy, which is increasingly opposed and in stark opposition to the foreign policy of the government. It has its own security forces, which are paid by the central government, ironically enough, but does not listen to the central government. It has its own judicial system. So these all accusations do not hold any water. And on top of that, the dramatic surge in the violence and the dramatic surge in the powers and influence Al-Qaeda is directly linked to the arming, to the funding, to the paying of salaries, to the logistical support, which have been given directly by Saudi Arabia, by Qatar, to Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, which has been now, according to the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has said clearly that it is part and parcel and merely an extension of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the head of Jabhat al-Nusra is simply a foot soldier belonging to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That indicates and proves beyond the shadow of doubt that all the funding, all the logistical support, all the arming and the paying of salary have actually gone directly from Saudi Arabia and Qatar to reinvigorate, revitalize and throw Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a vital lifeline, and that's why we see that dramatic surge in the ability of Al-Qaeda, which are also using the protests in the Sunni area.
Let me just get a reaction from Richard Weiss there. Richard Weiss, what do you think about that? That not only the Sunni minorities, but obviously Al-Qaeda in Iraq, backed by Saudi Arabia, as our guest said there, backed by Qatar, has emboldened actually what is going on inside Syria in terms of the Al-Qaeda, such as the Al-Nusra Front, fighting the Syrian government?
I guess there are two comments I'd make. First, the important point, our other guests point out that, yes, the Sunnis and the Kurds had representation within the national government, and they had certain autonomous rights that haven't been encroached upon. And it appears in some cases they have exceeded what you might would think would be acceptable for a nation state, such as negotiating directly with foreign governments. But the key thing is the perception. And if they talk to the leaders of the Kurds, you talk to the leaders of Sunnis, they think that al-Maliki in particular has arrogated all the key decision making to himself and just ignores the other officials. He's kept this post of defense minister, he's kept the key positions to either for himself or to his very close colleagues, that he's established independent authorities such as his own security forces that are operating independent of the government, and therefore they have no influence in that decision. So their perception is that they don't really have any say in national government policy on the issues that are important to them. With respect to the foreign dimension, It's complex, since we all appreciate that many countries have a role in what's happening in Iraq, broadly defined. The Turks have very good ties Turkey has very good ties with the Kurdish region, Kurdistan. The Iran has very good ties with the Maliki government and some of the Shiite groups. The United States' influence has waned considerably with the pull of U.S. troops, but it still has close ties with some members of the army. And then the Saudis and so on, the Persian Gulf, of course, have ties with some of the Sunni tribal leaders. And we haven't seen, which is good, we haven't really seen this kind of turn into some kind of Cold War or even actually war proxies in which you have different groups ally with different factions fighting it out the way they have in Syria. But I think your guest has raised a caution. I think we're a little worried that what's going to happen when the fighting ends in Syria, what's going to happen to all these guerrillas and so on? I mean, are they going to leave and go back to Iraq, in which case we really will have a bit of a mess? So it's something I think we're going to have to pay another, among the many issues we have to be concerned about in addressing the Syrian conflict is how to disarm and demilitarize the fighters once we get a settlement.
I'm going to ask that question of Zaid Alisa after we listen to some of the viewer comments as posted on the Facebook page. Let's take a listen.
The game is very clear. Weaken Iraq so Qatar and Saudi Arabia can do what the U.S. and Israel dictate in order to serve U.S. and Israeli interests in the Middle East. Al-Qaeda and former Ba'athists are behind the terror attacks in Iraq. Which countries are supporting these terrorists? The answer is Qatar and Saudi Arabia. I guess the US has given the green light to Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Turkey to instigate and fund terrorists to disturb Maliki's government and keep Iraq away from any possible regional role. The US has lost the war in Iraq as it was forced to withdraw from Iraq. Some Arab countries do not want to see a successful Shia-led government in Iraq. The US and these Arab countries are aiming to keep Iraq weak and busy with its own internal problems.
Some of the viewer comments there are posted on our Facebook page for the subject of this debate. We had so many of them. But one thing that I'd like to address to you, Zaid Alisa, is the U.S. role. Two of the comments there mentioned the U.S. In particular, do you think the U.S. has given the green light to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey to instigate and fund, as our viewer said there, terrorists to disturb Maliki's government?
Well, that is absolutely doubtless. They couldn't act on their own without consent and the green light from the from the U.S. administration. And that is documented by the New York Times, which have suggested in many articles that the funding, the arming, which has gone ahead by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which have been, which have intensified recently, and have suggested even that the most of the funding and the arming have found its way to Jabhat al-Nusra, which is part and parcel of al-Qaeda, turning it into the most lethal, potent, and most savage, brutal force, which is highly effective. And now, by the way, since that dramatic and massive influx converging on Syria of mercenaries from all around, backed up by Saudi Arabia and paid by the Saudi authorities, that's what they declared, that's what their foreign minister has said, it's an excellent idea, and the use of all necessary means, which Ayman al-Zawahiri has responded to by saying that the central front is Syria. Now they have enough resources, which, by the way, al-Qaeda in Iraq said that it shares all the resources with Jabhat al-Nusra, are finding their way back into Iraq, and now they have dramatically strengthened their hand, and we are seeing now the results on the streets of Iraq by the mass killing, which is basically mostly sectarian in nature, and is targeting the overwhelming majority of Iraq, which has the Shias, and in some cases targeting Sunnis, in order to spark and instigate the sectarian war, which will basically serve the Saudis, which are finding it now increasingly difficult to convince their people that they are still the guardians of Sunni Islam, particularly that they adhere to the Wahhabi Salafi religious establishment, which provides the government with the necessary legitimacy, and because their people have seen that the Saudi regime have backed up the tyrannical regimes in Egypt, Yemen, and they want to convince their people that they are engaged in backing up the Sunnis. That's why they need to see a sectarian war in order to be seen confronting an existential threat coming from the Shias, mainly right. From the Islamic Republic of Iran. But it is true that those volunteers are going back to Iraq because there are plenty of them, and they have started off this relentless campaign of bombing because they have so much resources now, and there is a desperate need to weaken Iraq because Iraq has been vehemently opposed and fiercely against the arming, the financing of the Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, because they knew very well that okay. is going to backfire, and we're going to witness the effect
on the streets of Iraq.
I need to ask
Richard White the same question. Is the U.S. involved in this in terms of giving the green light to Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey?
I thought those comments were interesting because U.S. policy has always been actually the opposite. It's been to try and have a strong government in Baghdad that, as I said, would respect the constitution the Americans left them, but would otherwise have a strong enough military and strong enough central authority so that it wouldn't be inclined, as what the Americans feared when they were withdrawing, to come under the control of Iran. So they were trying to build up a strong government in Baghdad that could be basically, although not have bad relations with Iran, would still be sufficiently independent. What you're having now, though, with the spread of the insurgency and the other protests, is it's Maliki sort of forced to turn to Tehran for a lack of other close foreign allies. Now, that's been limited because, you know, the Russians are willing to sell them weapons. The Americans are still trying to work with Maliki. The Americans are pretty neutral, I would say, in this current fight. Because again, I think their strategy is really to have an Iraq that's strong enough to basically balance what would presumably otherwise be the dominant regional power, which would be
Iran. Yeah, but there's also the other argument there, sorry to jump in, Richard Weiss, that say, well, you know, the U.S. And its allies, including the regional countries, they want to take power away from Iran, to take the influence of Iran away and detract it, Syria being one of the resistance blocks countries, and then, of course, Iraq being an ally with Iran. So at this point, why not have Iraq get destabilized? And, of course, you have Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey leading the way.
Well, I think that the thinking is that Maliki, despite his many flaws as a manager and his desire basically to emulate Saddam Hussein in the sense amount of power he has, although not presuming Saddam's cruelties, is still at heart an Iraqi nationalist rather than an Iranian puppet. And so therefore you want to strengthen him and his government, and basically if you can get all the Iraqis unified and these tensions help develop the economy, build up their military, then that would serve as a natural counterweight. It wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards Iraq, and historically you could imagine them being rivals. If it's a weak government, besieged, attacked by insurgents, then you're sort of risk driving it under the control of Iran. So I would argue actually the obverse of your position.
Well, Zaid al-Issat, I'm trying to understand the picture over here. You have what is going on in Syria, the war on Syria, and then you have what is going on in Iraq. What could they be thinking in terms of trying to stabilize the countries involved here after supposed scenarios? Whether there's going to be some type of referendum that we're looking at 2014 in Syria, or we're looking at Iraq who's going down this road of violence and deaths. I mean, I'm trying to understand what kind of game plan does the U.S. and the regional allies and countries have when it comes to Iraq vis-a-vis Syria. Our guests there mentioned many of these fighters are going to return back to Iraq. Are we still going to see this violence continue in Iraq? Are we going to see a civil war just continue like it has in the past 2 years in Syria and Iraq?
Well, the thinking behind that is becoming increasingly apparent. Now, the strategy that was adopted at the beginning by Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they moved swiftly to tackle the Syrian government. They basically have convinced Al-Qaeda through their dramatic influence that if you concentrate and break Syria, then Iraq will automatically fall by actually forming a Sunni radical government, which is along the lines or strategically aligned with the Wahhabi Salafi government in Saudi Arabia and also backed up by Qatar. That was the thinking, and that's why Ayman al-Zawahiri had told all his followers to converge on Syria, which they did. But after 1 year of their concerted, relentless effort and their strenuous campaign to actually topple the regime in Syria, they are still struggling, and that's why the thinking have dramatically changed, and they think that they have to go back to Iraq in order to dramatically weaken Iraq, destabilize Iraq, which the Saudis have perceived as a major threat since day one. Since 2003, they never recognized the democratic change in Iraq. They never had a diplomatic representation in Iraq till 2012. And according to and their fatwas,
yeah,
which I have to say are governmental fatwas, have instrumental
Thank
in
you
encouraging
very much, Zaid al-Issat. Zaid al-Issat there. Iraq Affairs expert talking to us from London. From Washington, we had Richard Weiss from the Center for Political Military Analysis from the Huntsman Institute. Thank you very much. And thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. Any questions or comments that you may have, do send it to us. Newsroom@presstv.ir is our email address. From Mikhail Tafai and the team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.